Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. Today's guest is Siobhan McDonagh, Dame Siobhan McDonagh, the Labour MP for Mitcham and Morden since the 1st of May 1997. She is on the progressive wing of the Labour Party, a Blairite. We talk about that and so many other things, not just about her life and career. Her sister Margaret McDonagh, who was the General Secretary of the Labour Party, she sadly passed away last year, and the work that Siobhan is doing to raise awareness of brain cancer and rare brain cancer. But about life and what your approach to life is. This is one of those wonderful conversations that we talk about politics and there's so much great stuff in here, but also just what's your approach to life? Maybe I am becoming a bit more philosophical after everything that's happened, but this becomes a far deeper conversation about all sorts of things, and it is an absolute pleasure, and Siobhan is a national treasure. This is just class, from someone who is so impressive because she's never lost that stamina for wanting to get things changed for the better and really animated about tackling the problems we face as a society, and what a tireless campaigner she is. This is wonderful. So I will shut up and you can enjoy Siobhan McDonagh. Siobhan, I was just looking at the history of Mitcham and Morden and the elections there. Now, you were elected on the 1st of May 1997, which obviously is a date seared in the minds of Labour people and of many people in the country. But you'd stood for that seat twice before, so 10 years of standing for election in that constituency before you got elected. And what I didn't appreciate was the presence of the National Front over quite a sustained period in that seat. I mean, when you first stood in 1987, what was the tone of that election like?
Well, I suppose we were much younger and more naive, so we didn't really know what we were about or what we were doing. But yeah, I mean, there were areas of the constituency that were very, very tough. The Labour Party was not very popular at the time. And, you know, we would canvass on one occasion. I know that one of my friends had dogs off on them. There would be some levels of intimidation, but it didn't stop us or deter us. It made us more determined.
I mean, maybe that is the naivety of youth. And maybe the context was slightly different. You know, it just made me think about everything that's been happening recently with Lindsay Hoyle and obviously just with Joe Cox and David Amis, and just the attacks on other MPs like Stephen Timms. And when we're talking about the security of our elected representatives and people who stand for election, it seems like periodically you are put through experiences that, frankly, maybe in other countries you might be given more security for.
I think the issue of security is a very difficult one, because I would, when I'm not quite thinking about it, I would say to you what I feel, which is I never feel intimidated or threatened. The constituent is incredibly kind and tolerant. When Margaret died, my sister died, you know, I couldn't go out the front door without somebody stopping me in the street to say how sorry they were. And I think, oh gosh, no, I don't want the lovely security guard I have at my weekly advice surgery to be there. But I think I also have a responsibility to other people who don't feel the same way and who feel more intimidated, often for very good reasons, to take it seriously and understand that often these the serious threat, the very real threat, can be a matter of chance rather than anything else. Because often we know, certainly we know from David Amos, that the person who murdered him had been to other advice surgeries, had been to the House of Commons several times. So it was just random that David Amos was the terribly unfortunate victim there. So, you know, I have to get the balance right.
And did you feel, standing against the National Front, I mean, you know, Margaret Hodge went through that experience with the BNP in 2005, and other candidates have had that really intense focus of the far right on them. But these are really dangerous, violent people. But it sounds like actually you didn't feel intimidated at the time.
Well, maybe we felt intimidated, but we just did it anyway. There wasn't a feeling that, you know, these people might be rude to you, swear at you, you know. But you never really believed that they were a threat to your life. And we were tough and determined and, you know, we just wanted Labour to win, and we had to wait a very long time for that.
Yeah, well, indeed.
That's kind of the case. When I go into primary schools and secondary schools, I say, you know, losing is as much part of life as winning. And if you really want something, you've just got to get yourself up and back at it. You know, that, I mean, I don't remember ever hearing the word resilience until really quite recently. You know, that in schools, part of what they do now is talking about resilience and trying to make children more resilient. I just thought we never had any choice. You just had to get up and get on with it.
And you had been involved in local politics before getting elected in 1997. You've been on the council. But obviously you and your sister, Margaret, who was the first ever female General Secretary of the Labour Party, as you mentioned, sadly passed away last year. And I'd like to talk about her in more detail in a bit. But where do you think both of your political drive came from?
I think it was becoming from an Irish family and being kind of gobby teenagers, really, that, you know, we rowed about everything. And, you know, having a newspaper in the house was really an essential part of life. You know, we'd fight over all, my mum, and the first thing my dad would, you know, when we went to church on a Sunday, we'd always come home and have a row about the sermon, you know. And I think my dad particularly was just relieved when it was the Labour Party we joined rather than anything to the left of that.
And were you both always, because you're very much seen on the right of the party, the progressive side, the Blairite side, was that always the case, or did you have a radical phase?
I don't know. Perhaps you don't like to remember you ever changed, you know what I mean? But you do evolve, and you do. I think we were. I hope that we were about always wanting to make a change, make a difference. And you very quickly understood that actually you win elections from the centre. You've got to be in power to do the things you want to do. You know, I look at the people who come to my advice surgery, and I just think about how much less I can do for them now than I used to be able to. You know, people will stop me in the street and say, oh, Siobhan, you know, you helped me to get a house or a flat back in 2012, and I just say to them, I wouldn't be able to do the same thing now.
Why not?
No housing stock, lots more people becoming homeless. My constituency is Mitcham and Morden, but the London Borough, the council, is Merton, and we currently have 550 families in temporary accommodation, which, don't get me wrong, is low for London, but we've never seen that before. You know, you'd be in bad times, you'd be down at 100, but it's just risen exponentially, and it just at the moment feels no solution, no end.
And when you think about where Labour is on all these things now, it seems as if they're the party saying, you know, we'll be different to the Tories, but times are difficult. We might not be able to do everything. I mean, how much faith do you have that if Labour are privileged enough to win the next general election, that they'll be able to transform those numbers in your constituency over a 5 or 10 year period?
One of the things that I've been really excited about is how much Keir Starmer talks about housing and building houses, because there's no magic bullet to this. It's only getting more houses to rent and to buy that we're going to find our way out of it. And one of the things I take comfort from is we all know there's not going to be a lot more money unless we grow the economy. And one of the most effective ways of growing the economy is to build houses.
So do you think, your perspective on this is really fascinating because you've been an MP since the day Labour last came from opposition into government. And you had some junior ministerial roles, but when you came into Parliament, were you ambitious to like one day lead the party? Because MPs have all different types of ambitions and some of them are obviously very personally driven to get to the top of the greasy pole. Others are there to serve the country and the party in whatever way they can. Has your ambition changed over time or were you always just effectively happy to serve wherever you could?
Just happy to get on with it. You know, my priority was, it took me a long time to get elected. And so once I had, I wanted to do the very best I could for my constituents and to do a good job that people might actually think we'd like to vote for her again. And I haven't really moved from that position in what is now 26 years, which I don't know whether that shows a lack of imagination on my part, but it's still where I am.
And, you know, you sit among your colleagues and the churn has been incredible over the last few years. I mean, when you think of the parliamentary party that you who you would have been sat next to when you first got elected compared to how the people you sit next to now, I mean, must be barely anyone left that was a colleague in 97 who still won in 2024.
Margaret Hodge and Harriet Harman are still here, but obviously they're standing down next time. Everybody else is... Angela Regal, maybe, but most people, yeah. My greatest friends have left, you know, Joan Ryan, Jackie Smith, Caroline Flint, Hazel Blears, yeah.
Obviously, Joan Ryan was one of the people that joined the independent group when Jeremy Corbyn was leading the Labour Party. Did you ever come close to leaving the party at that time?
I wouldn't have left if I couldn't hold a by-election because that was kind of important to me. And I suppose you keep trying to bring the party back where I would see it as to being sensible and to being in a position to represent people. So party in 1976, I was back there. It isn't a great deal of fun, but it has to be done.
And it felt like, though, that obviously Labour's had periods in the wilderness before, but the Corbyn experience felt very unique. It did feel different to Michael Foot. It was obviously very distinct from Neil Kinnock. Without Keir Starmer winning the last leadership contest, things again could have been very different. I mean, at any point, did you ever wonder or worry more about the existence of the Labour Party?
Oh, yeah. I thought there was every prospect if we carried on in that way, we would cease to exist. We would cease to be relevant to people. In 2019, at the general election, it was when, a lot of people who would be our core Labour vote in Wimbledon, in London, you know, kind of black women, middle-aged black women, were beginning to say, I just don't know if I can vote Labour, Siobhan. At that point, you think, this is really tough. We're in a really difficult place because if it's like that, somewhere like Mitcham and Morden, who knows what it's like in far more marginal places. So yeah, I could have seen the prospect of us just becoming entirely irrelevant.
And did you ever have any moves to deselect you? Did the nature of your local party change a lot in those years?
Not really. We had a few vocal people, and we would have a few rows. But as you know, I'm not really frightened of having a row about politics with anybody. One person in the reselection in the run-up to 2019, one person voted against me, and we know who they are.
Are they still a member?
Yeah.
Do you get on all right with them?
Yeah.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, I don't think you can afford to take things too personally. I think you just, maybe it shouldn't be like this, but you do have to. And you inevitably grow a thicker skin, don't you? I mean, you just, you know, like, people can say what the hell they like about me on social media. It really doesn't bother me. Let them get on with it.
And I mean, you're vocal on social media. You've got a good social media presence. You're engaging on there. Have you found it difficult at times?
No, not really, because I don't think it's real life. You know, Twitter, X, I mean, it's an echo chamber, isn't it? Intensely political people. If you have a Twitter name that isn't your real name, you know people are just going to chuck rubbish at you because they're not brave enough to present themselves as saying the things they say. So, gosh, say what you like about me. It won't be the worst thing I've ever said about me. Probably won't be the worst thing I've said about myself.
And how do you rate Keir Starmer then? I mean, you know, he's ahead in the polls. Labour are winning these by-elections.
I didn't vote for Keir Starmer as leader.
No. You were supporting Jess Phillips.
And when Jess fell out, dropped out, I thought I supported Lisa Nandy. So, but I have to say, I thank God for him every morning. I think he's doing a great job. Probably the worst job in politics, being leader of the opposition. Just a long, hard slog. And I think he's doing a brilliant job. I think he's brought us to a place where we are, you know, you don't feel ashamed anymore. And is coming up with interesting, really interesting ideas. And I think we're beginning to see more of him. And I can understand anybody's reticence about it showing people their real self. But I thought, I watched the Sky interview with Sophie Ridge and Keir this week, and I, you know, it almost brought me to tears when he was talking about his dad and his relationship with his dad.
Very emotional.
And that takes time, doesn't it? Yeah.
It must be, if you're naturally not someone who overshares, it must be very odd when you just want to get on and make the country better to have to do that as part of it. But so you support Jess Phillips and then Lisa Nandy. Was that entirely down to their politics versus Keir's, or was it also something to do with the fact that Labour has never elected a woman in its entire history to lead it?
I think Jess Phillips is a force of nature. I think she's great. I think she really speaks to people, and she's a great communicator, which is why I supported her. I then supported Lisa Nandy because I thought she was coming up with some really interesting ideas and thinking about what Labour had to do to make it put itself in a position to win the general election. And if I'm brutally honest, and I'm not sure if I should say this out loud, but I kind of thought, you know, Keir, why didn't you stand up to Jeremy Corbyn more? But I've kind of made my peace with that now. And I understand that, you know, partisans like me could never have fought for the Labour Party, the soul of the Labour Party, and won it, because you had to bring some of our members on a journey. And that is what Keir has done. And I have to say that I am a great fan of Morgan McSweeney, who's our director of strategy, but he saw it. He saw Keir as leader. He didn't walk away. Lots of people did. He stayed, he fought, and he made him the leader of the Labour Party. And I will always, for one, be absolutely personally thankful to him for that.
How difficult do you find it? You know, you self-described partisan. How difficult do you find it having to constantly have this conversation within the Labour Party about the fact that it can only win when it is positioned by the centre ground, and anything else effectively is self-indulgence that will lose general elections?
Well, obviously, my first reaction is to want to shout at people. But let me tell you, Matt, it doesn't really work. You know, human nature is such that none of us want to believe that we're wrong. So you entrench people's position. So I suppose you have to have a dialogue with people and try and bring them along and explain why you see it the way you do. And sometimes you're successful and sometimes you're not. And sometimes people's politics is so entrenched, particularly on the hard left, that actually it's not part of the Labour tradition. Well, and it's not the home. Yeah, it's not the home for them, is it?
Well, it was one of the darkly comic elements of the Corbyn experience was that they didn't understand their own history. In fact, they were completely ignorant of Labour history and what it was. And Labour's history with NATO and the nuclear deterrent and being a patriotic party and all those things were just...
Yeah,
they were ignorant of them. They didn't even know that was part of Labour's DNA.
Yeah, yeah. One of the women who's always on the telly, she's a luxury communist, you know, that what is her surname? Blakely or... I was on Politics Live with her the other day.
Oh, Grace Blakely, I think it is. Grace,
yeah, yeah. And I didn't feel myself with absolute glory when she was talking about the seeds of change have never come from Labour being elected, but communities rising up and organising themselves. So unfortunately, the best I came out with at the moment that was to say that is absolute rubbish. You know, all for communities getting together and organising and finding their own solutions. And we have a proud cooperative history in the Labour Party that's done that. But the big fundamental changes have happened from Labour being elected.
Well, that's why it was formed, was to clause one is to be a party of government. This is what the Labour Party exists for, is to win, to represent everyone in Parliament. I mean, I often think the difference actually is that those people just really enjoy protesting, and then they try and make out that it actually achieves something. They're just going on marches and waving postcards.
An element of poverty porn in it as well, isn't it? Kind of sometimes we can indulge in that. You know, we have this kind of fairly mythologized view about people and about groups. When any group, whatever it is only as good as its members and its belief and direction. And I think most people just want a government to get elected and to do the things it wants them to do. It doesn't necessarily want to be involved in it as well.
No,
they expect us to go on and do it, don't they?
Poverty porn is really, it really drives me mad when I hear people, clearly very privileged people, talking about what the working class needs. And I, particularly when they're completely out of step with what working class people are like, I find it offensive.
Yeah.
Class seems to be the one element of privilege we don't want to talk about in this country. You know, sometimes you fill in questionnaires for things. I filled in a questionnaire for a venue that I played a few years ago, and it was asking me about what gender I identified with, all these other things. About race, about all the things it should ask about. Not one question about class. Not a question about class at all. And it's something in the arts, which obviously the Labour is talking about this week, but wider, can't address class privilege, because actually it's 7% of the population go to private school, and yet they're so overly represented in government, the media, the arts, anywhere where decisions are made. You know, there's way more than 7% of people in leadership positions in those, and they hire people like themselves.
Oh, yeah, which makes it a real struggle for any form of meritocracy, isn't there? You know, and for working class kids to get on the same program. We were talking about the number of children and young people who should go to university, and you know, there was much scorn about Tony Blair's 50% target to get 50% of kids. And one of the Tories said, oh, and I think it would be better if people stayed in their same towns and they they got jobs locally and they didn't go away to university. And I said, but that's not for your son and daughter, is it?
Yeah.
The thing is that when they want to cut kids going to university, it's always working class kids they want to cut.
It is. And it's the same as home ownership. And they say, actually, we should have this European model. Why are we so obsessed? I guarantee you, anyone who says that has got a mortgage.
Yeah.
And
another thing I probably shouldn't be saying, I just think, you know, Tampa is right to buy at your peril, because that was the most effective transfer of money, of opportunity to working class people that Mrs. Thatcher's government actually really introduced. And we can argue now about what happened to the stock, but why was it council tenants' jobs to provide future homes for people who needed them? Why wasn't it all our responsibility?
I mean, these things go to the heart of why, for so long, Labour was not seen as the party of ambition and not the party of working people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And people frustrated because people wanted to get on, didn't they? They wanted a better life. They saw that if you owned your own home, you had an asset. It made life better. And it maybe you got to give some of it back to your kids, you know, when you died. And I think the lack of ability to understand that is a problem sometimes for Labour. And as I said, I think we mess with it at our peril.
I mean, even it's just small things, isn't it? It's all those big things. But it's also just the fact that it feels like it's yours, that you don't have to ask permission to redecorate it or to do something to it. You know, that individual freedom you've got over your own nest. And I think a lot of people in politics and political activism lose sight of actually what politics is for. And one thing that I wanted to ask you about, because I think we probably have this in common, is one of the things that really appealed to me about the Blair era was that it's not just about ambition. It was the fact that it allowed people to dream a bit and to be able to say, actually, I can do something with my life. Like it goes to the heart of what you were saying about the Tory run with about people staying in their towns. For people who want to do that, that's absolutely the right thing for them. But a government should be seeking to allow people to express themselves and achieve whatever it is that they choose to study, whether that's academic or work-based or whatever, to move abroad should they wish. You know, we should be enabling people to lead the lives they dream of.
Oh, absolutely. And I think sometimes politicians don't know how people do live their lives. I remember we were out on a street stall, 1998 or something, and this couple of young women came up to me and they said, Siobhan, tax credits, it's changed our lives. You know, we can save and take our family on a holiday. So all the people who criticise tax credits, I'm sure they probably got to go on holiday once every year, at minimum. But for that fact, those two women, that opportunity for that basic thing for their family, that bit of luxury, that bit of hope, that something to look forward to, was transformative. And when you talk to people, I mean, Angela Rayner's a case in point, but when you talk about the effect of Sure Start, you know, you could take your baby somewhere, you could engage with other mums, you'd get advice, you'd get support. And if there were things going wrong, there were people there who could see that it was going wrong. One of the things that's really shocked me is when I go into primary schools, head teachers, the first thing they always want to talk to me about is kids not being school ready. So I did a survey recently of all my primary schools, and the biggest health issue was tooth decay, and the amount of children had to have teeth removed. And, you know, the fact that, and this is I think this is a really terrible thing, you do a phonics test in reception the year you go in, and there were some children who couldn't do the phonics test because they couldn't move their mouths in a way to do the test because they had so many teeth removed.
I mean, this is absolutely terrifying, you know, and this, what do you put that down to then? Is that just that we had austerity and all the rest of it, and that subsequent iterations of the Tory party haven't effectively, you know, they removed Sure Start and things like that? Or are there other things as well not to do with government?
I think if there were one thing, it would be easy to solve, wouldn't it? But there's a kind of removal of any kind of support for family, for young families. You know, so Sure Start's there, not there anymore. But, you know, the mums and toddlers drop in around the corner at the church hall isn't there. Health visitors are being cut back, you know, particularly with potty training, which is a kind of quite an issue as well. Back in the day, you know, the health visitor, who would be like an older woman who was, you know, very jolly hockey sticks, would go in and say, right, come on, we'll potty train little Johnny today. And there was that help and that support. If you don't have any family members, or you see you there aren't those people there to support you, I think it must be very hard. I mean, some people will always, the vast majority of people will always manage, but sometimes it can be tough. And what the head teachers always say to me, look, you put what you like on the internet, but if there isn't a human being encouraging behaviour or giving advice, then it's very difficult to make progress.
Because everywhere you look at the moment, it feels like the country is eroding. The state of the roads, the state of public services, the police, schools, hospitals. When you're talking about the oral hygiene and health of young people now, and the impact on whether they can actually speak properly or not.
Yeah.
When you think of the state of the country and what Labour effectively is saying is it's going to be really difficult for us to do anything, do you think that is just Keir Starmer managing the expectations of a country, and that, like Blair, actually there'll be more radical things that aren't perhaps even in the manifesto? Or do we have to brace ourselves for a government that will take better decisions and that will redistribute a bit, but that actually things may not massively get better?
I think things will improve, but it will take time. And you have to expectation manage, don't you? Because you don't want people to become disappointed and cynical about what you're doing. I mean, in 1997, if you remember the famous pledge card, I mean, the things we pledged on that, they were really quite small, weren't they? But they were emblematic of the direction of travel. I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day and said, well, I think on the pledge part card, we agreed that we'd remove outside toilets in school. Well, you know, that seems ridiculous now, doesn't it? It's hard to imagine that there were outside toilets in schools. But, you know, but it was about the direction of travel. And I think that is what you have to, it's just what you have to do, because it is going to be hard. I mean, who would be daft enough to think it won't?
But do you think once we get into a campaign, that excitement and that thrill will sort of spread through the country a bit? At the moment, I don't know. I don't, for medical reasons, I've not been out there much in the last few months. But
yeah.
What's the mood in your constituency? Obviously, it's been Labour for a while, but do you sense that there's a sense of excitement that we might actually get a new government?
Well, I don't think Mitch Mamorden is much of a barometer of anything, or what people say to me is, because generally people are always really lovely, really excited and all the rest of it. And I think not just Mitch Mamorden, but London as a whole is another country. You know, I've done quite a lot of work in by-elections over the last few months, and I do think people are really fed up. I think they all say that the country is in a mess, and some fatalistically think that we can't make it better. So, and that I think in turn leads to a kind of lack of faith in politicians and our ability to do anything or make anything better. So I think that's really hard. And you do have to marry the truthful argument that it will be tough and it won't happen overnight, and that's why we've got to win well enough to get two terms. But you have to partner that with a little bit of optimism and hope, because I think people really need hope at the moment, because there's the terrible feeling of fatalism.
It does feel, I can't remember the country being this bad in my adult life. I mean, obviously there are improvements that come as a result of technology, but just in terms of the way the country has been governed and the state of the public realm, and even though I've had exceptional treatment for cancer and surgery in other areas, the NHS doesn't work so well, and people who work in it know that, and people trying to get a GP appointment know that. It actually feels like, I don't know how long it would take to sort these problems out. I mean, I'm sure there are things that with investment and reform you can solve a little bit faster, but it really feels that, it feels like there's a sense of urgency, actually, that even if we have to wait till November or December to have a general election, the damage done in that time will be so deep.
Yeah, it will. But I mean, I have every faith we can turn the NHS round. We did it last time. We did it in 97. When we left office in 2010, we had the lowest waiting lists and the highest satisfaction levels ever in the NHS. And I got great confidence in Wes Streeting, our health spokesperson, because I think he is, you know, he does say that more money, yes, but reform as well. That's important, isn't it? You know, it's that whole Einstein definition of madness. If you keep doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome. So we have to look at ways we do things and be brave enough to do that, which is always a bit of challenge for Labour, because often we can be a kind of very conservative party and want to keep doing things the same way, and we just simply can't. And I think about the things that really changed the lives of people in my constituency under Labour were the changes we made to the NHS. I mean, I'm probably the only living person who defends PFI and academy schools. I mean, the academy schools that came, you know, Labour's academy schools, you know, when we tackled failing schools. I don't think it works under Michael Gove's plan of making everyone an academy, because you simply don't get enough great sponsors to do that. But, you know, I had secondary schools in Mitcham and Morden, which were in the bottom 1% of performers in London. London was a basket case in terms of schools. And now it's the best in the country. The schools, secondary schools I have in my constituency, all of which are academies, are outstanding. And though I am absolutely confident, even in these straitened times, those young people are getting a better education than they would have prior to 1997.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Now, I'm as Blairite as they come, Siobhan.
Probably not more Blairite than me.
Well, this is what I'm going to come on to.
We could have a competition, couldn't we?
Well, it's because you mentioned PFI. I mean, I think I still agree with it. But the spiralling costs of some of them feel slightly harder to defend. So what is the Siobhan McDonough rebuttal of that of that argument?
I think some of the contracts were very badly negotiated. I don't think that in the private sector, in the public sector, we're renowned for being good making deals on contracts with the private sector. I think maybe we got better over time. You got more people in who knew what they were doing, but some of the deals are scary and how poor they are. But what I would say, and it's I would say in defence of the initiative, we wanted the new hospitals, we wanted the new hospital wings, and we wanted the new schools, and we didn't want to wait for them. And we couldn't use the traditional model of going out and borrowing the money, because as we've seen from Liz Truss, there are big consequences to unfettered borrowing without knowing how you're going to pay it back. And I don't think Gordon Brown would have let us get away with that. And it's just as well that he wouldn't. So if you want it now, then you have to accept that you need another way of doing it. And it might cost you slightly more in the long term, but you want the thing you want now. And as my defence, my practical defence, I don't know if you've ever been to St George's Hospital in Tooting, but there is a neurosurgery wing called the Atkinson Morley, which is named after quite a well-known hospital that used to be up in Wimbledon. So it was closed and brought to St George's. And part of the contract deal, of course, with PFI is that you're not only the private sector company who build it, also require that it's maintained because it's their asset rather than the NHS's. So when you go into a PFI unit like the Atkinson Morley, it always looks so much better than its equivalent part in the hospital. Because what we do in the public sector is when money gets tight, we scrap the decorating, or we put it on a longer cycle, or we don't do the repairs, or, you know, but you can't do that under PFI. So you have to keep the discipline of keeping the building in a good condition. And obviously there are risks in that, because the private company is going to negotiate a really expensive deal on maintenance and all the rest of it, and cleaning and stuff like that. But I see the advantages as getting the thing that you want, and also the fact that you're going to end up maintaining it to a better way. That doesn't mean mistakes weren't made, doesn't mean some of the deals weren't good enough. But at the Atkinson Morley Wing in St George's Hospital, since maybe 2000, the early 2000s when it's built, there are hundreds of people who are alive because they were treated well for their strokes in an amazing facility.
Obviously, the NHS close to not just Labour hearts, but people of all political persuasions,
yeah.
But particularly relevant given that your sister Margaret passed away last year from a very rare form of brain cancer. And I know you've dedicated a lot of your time to raising awareness and money to try and find a cure for it. How effective do you think the treatment Margaret received on the NHS was?
The treatment was, and is for all people who have glioblastoma, is currently useless. I think that we are putting people through treatment that makes life really tough and doesn't really extend their lives by any significant amount of time. So there's been no improvement in the treatment of glioblastoma brain tumours for 40 years. You have surgery, you have then 8 weeks of radiotherapy, and then you have as much chemotherapy as you can take, and then it's all over and you just wait to die. And that sounds quite brutal, because it really is that brutal. And if you're lucky enough to have enough money, you can extend, you might be able to extend your life, but that will be mainly by going to other countries, going to Germany as we did, or going to America. And it's a shame on this country, and it's a huge injustice to the 3,200 people who will be diagnosed with this sort of brain tumour in the next year.
And what are they doing in Germany, America, that we're not doing here?
Well, in Germany, they have a more permissive kind of system, where if you've basically got a terminal illness, there's lots of things that you can try. And that isn't the same in the UK, which is much more cautious. With that, we've also seen the collapse in drug trials in the UK. I mean, we're being outperformed by so many countries in the world, and some of them will surprise you. Spain, they're doing a terrific job there of improving the number of trials that they have. Germany, as you'd expect, are very good. America's great because there's lots of money and lots of philanthropic giving, and it's the best place in the world to be ill if you're rich, and the worst place in the world to be ill if you're poor. And Israel are also really good at it as well. And I'm just hopeful, not only for glioblastoma, but for all the rare cancers where we've seen no real improvement for a very long time, that the Labour government will want to grow the economy, and so will realise that pharmaceutical science trials are all part of one of those growth areas that we've got fantastic science. We've got a captured market in that we all use the NHS, so there should be no reason why we're not good at it.
And why aren't we good at it?
A combination of things. It takes us extraordinarily long time to do things. So if you have a trial which is at a number of hospitals across the country, each hospital does individually their same investigations and paperwork. They don't say, oh, well, Hospital X did it, so let's replicate what Hospital X did. No, they do it right from the start. And by the time they've got round to it and finished it, all the other countries have taken the places on the trial, because often these trials are international. And also because the NHS is in such a sorry state, that, you know, there's more concentration on just putting, you know, the holes in the dam of treatment, really, rather than doing the science and the trials as well. And of course, we have to mention our good friend Brexit, because obviously the European medicines went to the Netherlands. We lost a lot of our great scientists. So it's been poor all the way around. And also what I've learned is, yeah, that the NHS is innately conservative. Doctors too are also innately conservative and don't want to do things differently.
We're talking about Margaret. We should talk about her amazing life and career and just how special it is for both of you to, one, become General Secretary of the Labour Party, the other, to be a Labour MP and to be a government minister for a period of time. I mean, do you think your parents would ever have believed, or your grandparents would have ever believed, that you'd have both gone into those worlds and achieved so much?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I've just chaired a debate in Westminster Hall on St Patrick's Day and the Irish in Britain. And I think we were just incredibly lucky to be the, you know, to be the daughters of, you know, two people who came from Ireland, my dad to work on the buildings, my mum to be a nurse, who believed in family and community and hard work, you know. Yeah, hard work was our next religion to Catholicism, really. And yeah, we were just very fortunate to have the mum and dad that we did.
And obviously, one going the party staff route and another going the elected route, was that a reflection of any personality difference? Was Margaret more suited to behind the scenes and you more of a front woman?
I suppose, yes. She was quieter, more methodical, more private, whereas I was, you know, the big show-off, really.
But, you know, she obviously climbed to such the top of the tree, really, in terms of working for the party. And she holds a very special place in Labour history and in Labour people's hearts. She's not just the first and only female Labour General Secretary, but there was something about the party at that time and the way she ran it that really people see her as the most successful of all time and certainly the most important.
Well, there's a good reason for that, Matt, because she is the most successful of all time, because she organised, you know, two consecutive general election wins in 97 and 2001, which is the only time we've ever managed that. And that was her ambition. So by age 40, she had achieved her lifetime ambition. And I think the thing that I reflect about Margaret is that she just never stopped learning and developing. She was absolutely the reverse of what I was saying about the innate conservatism sometimes of the medical profession or the NHS, in that she always wanted to improve, always wanted to do things better. She, well, I'm sure you know, because you might have been on the end of a telling off for Margaret at some time. I'm not sure, but you know, she had such an attention to detail, and she was such a perfectionist. But she was able to join that with just being really, really kind.
I never got a telling off. I was a when I was an organizer, Peter Watt was the general secretary.
Oh, so right.
I think I got told off for my mobile phone bill once, but I think that was about it.
Yeah, you know, she wanted the best, and she believed in the power of politics to change people's lives and make lives better. And you know, that's why she was in it. And she was never somebody who was materialistic or anything. She didn't, you know, she wasn't interested. She wanted to be good at what she did. She wanted to be the best. She wanted the Labour Party to be the best.
When you think about your politics, and it's close to the centre, it's centre-left, it's Blairite, what goes along with a lot of that, and you really notice it now in the branding of the party, is an explicit patriotism. You see the Union Jack everywhere. With someone with such proud Irish roots and identity, how do you feel when you see a Labour leader standing in front of the Union Jack?
Well, I think they're absolutely right, aren't they? You can't give the flag to the right. And there are many things about this country. We're not talking about the famine today, obviously. But you've got to be so proud of, haven't you? I mean, it's not easy. And we've seen that over the last few months, to be a liberal democracy where people of all races and faiths and views and lifestyles come together and live 99.9% of the time peacefully and happily together. Seems like an extraordinary thing, easy thing to do, but in reality, you know, where does it happen? And I think that we need to be very proud of that. And maybe that's a bit esoteric, so we don't talk about it that much, but, you know.
But when, let's say, I don't know what your favourite sport is, but if England play Ireland at, you know, rugby last weekend or at football, what is this the equivalent of the Tebbit test, I guess, for you?
Yeah, well, yeah, no, I have to say that I would support Ireland. But actually, my dad would have said to me, Siobhan, no, you should support England because you were born here. And that's what you should do. I mean, I kind of disobeyed him on that, in that I would have supported Ireland, but that's as much about supporting the, you know, the one, you know, the one least likely to win, which is a kind of where we all are in Labour, really, because we are normally least likely to win. My dad's kind of attitude is the reason why, while I'm an MP, I'll never apply for an Irish passport.
What, treachery?
I'm a British MP, and I think I should be holding a British passport. And you know, it's a small thing, but you know, and people always expect that I have. But I just no, I don't. Yeah, couldn't do that.
But you could have both, and then when you're travelling, you could get into the shorter queue.
Ah, yeah, but that's not really how life works, is it? I just think you have to be straightforward. You have to be straightforward in your life, don't you? It's only when things get, that's a very small thing and you wouldn't really get in trouble for it. But yeah, you have to be clear and not get confused.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, my dad's always pestering me to get an Irish passport. And I do periodically, yeah. And I'm not an MP, obviously, but I do periodically think I would make things easier. But then there's a
part I think it's absolutely fine and great for you to have one. Just think... my job means that I shouldn't do that.
No. I mean, were you ever... Obviously, politics has been your life for so long in local government and in Parliament. Had you not been an MP, where do you think your life would have gone?
I'm not sure I'm employable. I mean, I like to run things and to make decisions, and I have got no technical skills whatsoever. You know, it's a pretty difficult place to be, I would have thought, in 2024. Before I became an MP, I worked for Battersea Church's Housing Trust, a housing association, and I ran schemes to find accommodation for homeless families. And I loved doing that because, again, it was quite entrepreneurial. I could go out, do it. I was my own boss. It was a successful scheme. But even there, I began to realise that my lack of, you know, computer skills and technical skills were ultimately going to hold me back.
But there are things you could have picked up. I mean, do you think that you're unemployable because you've been an MP so long? Or is there something about you that just prefers to get on and do stuff yourself?
Probably a combination of both of them, really. You know, I love my job every day. I get up, I love to come and do it, have some sort of crazy idea of something that we could do. And poor Sam, who works with me, who was talking to you earlier, I went in the other day and I said, I think we need to write to the top 10 pension funds and ask them if they'd like to invest in temporary accommodation in Merton so we can improve the quality of temporary accommodation. I just get a thing when the chief executives see at these pension funds, see this letter, they'll think, what on earth is she on about?
But you only need one. You know, this is in life, you do have to take a chance sometimes. And I think when you were talking about institutional conservatism earlier, it just naturally happens. People go, well, we tried that once and it didn't work. But sometimes organisations have a different perspective or a different priority. And it's always worth just in life, in politics, wherever, just trying your luck once or twice. Because over the course of a year, a couple of things will come off.
Oh, yeah. And the most extraordinary things can be successful. And I mean, that was one of the exciting, when I look back now at the kind of Labour years, what was so exciting is that you could have a suggestion and take it to Tony or whoever, and there might be a possibility of it happening. If I could just give you one example, on Friday, I'm going to the dinner for the 25th anniversary of Southwest London Orthopaedic Centre. And this is a centre that just replaces hips and knees. It doesn't do any trauma work, no accidents, just waiting list cases.
Okay.
And this orthopaedic consultant, Richard Field, after 97, would come to my advice surgery every week to talk to me about this, that he could do twice the number of hip and knee replacements on the same amount of money if he just had a centre where that's what they did exclusively. And I didn't know any better. So I said, oh, Mr. Field, don't come to my advice surgery. You know, there was general mayhem at it. I'll come and see you. And what's more, I'm going to get an appointment with Frank Dobson and we can talk to him about this idea. So we go and see Frank and Richard brings out his slides and shows him the place in America that he's been to and why he thinks this would be such a success. And lo and behold, I mean, somebody else somewhere else might also have had this idea, but 18 months, 2 years later, Swellyock, Southwest London Elective Orthopaedic Centre, opened on the Epsom Hospital site. And today, it's the largest hip and knee replacement centre outside America. It has the lowest stay, so shortest stay in hospital, lowest blood use, and lowest infection rate in the country.
That is phenomenal. So that should have, you'd hope, triggered other ones around the UK, but...
Yeah, and other ones did happen, but none of them quite as successful as Swellyock. I suppose they used different models. I mean, his model was absolutely simple and straightforward, and it absolutely worked. And such a source of great pride for Richard, who'll be there on Friday. And, you know, you think, you know, as an MP in a governing party, you can really take things and do things. Some of them might be quite small or some of them might be quite big, like Swellyock. But we've got loads of kind of examples of things we were able to do because simply we had the notion. And, you know, the person, again, back to our hero, the person who never wants to stick with the same way of doing things and constantly has a curious mind and wants to challenge the status quo, Tony Blair, got on and did it, didn't he? I mean, we all know in every large organisation, it's much easier to keep doing the same thing.
It is. And it slightly annoys me that some people don't appreciate just how dynamic the Blair years were, or just that approach to government and life and things and just trying things and being creative, that element of it really appealed to me. But you talk about Swellyoke. I think I've got that right. There's obviously another acronym.
W-L-E-O-C,
There's another acronym that that you've had an issue with, which is ULEZ. And obviously you're a Labour MP. You've got a Labour Mayor of London. If you disagree on something really big like that, and this isn't just something that affects London, there are low emission zones in cities across the UK now. How difficult is it to handle that disagreement when you're going into a general election year? You don't want to be having public rows with people, but you've got very real misgivings about one of his central policies.
I mean, it is quite difficult. I think the benefit of being a backbench MP and being one that's been here for a long time is more my ability just to say what I think. You know, people will just look heavenward and say, oh, that's just Siobhan, you know, and nobody has a go at me or anything. But I suppose for the ULEZ thing, I just felt I had to represent my constituents, that, you know, people were really seriously financially challenged by it. I felt it would cause greater pressure on home carers, people driving to people's houses to give care. I thought, we don't have enough people who are prepared to do that for the terrible money they get. And why are we going to make it harder? Or why are we going to affect small businesses? Because in outer London, they're what, you know, a lot of people do. I've got wards where lots of people are self-employed and do those sorts of job and need their vehicle. It just felt the wrong time to be doing this during a cost of living crisis, to make it more difficult for people. And people who were basically our people.
And what's his response been? Have you been able to have a constructive dialogue about it?
Oh, no, he's been absolutely fine. I mean, I can't imagine he kind of welcomed it that much. Who would? But I just felt that I had to stick up for these, I had to stick up for people, and that, you know, Labour can sometimes forget its very core supporters. And I just worried that we were, may be in a position where we were putting back the Brexit coalition.
I mean, this is a constant source of tension in the Labour Party throughout its history. The tension between wanting to do what's environmentally correct, but also things that then disproportionately impact working people, and not marrying the two together. I mean,
we're back to that home ownership thing, aren't we?
Well, exactly. You can't. You know, it's one thing to very nobly want to improve the air that Londoners breathe, and you know, you notice it in London that the air quality isn't as good as when you go to other parts of even England, let alone if you're up in Scotland. But you have to do it in a way that is affordable for people. I mean, with anything like this, you surely need to create incentives rather than disincentives to do, in inverted commas, the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, also, I mean, it's like any big scheme that you introduce. There's some very difficult things in it. Like, we were inundated because you could get an extension on your ability to use your vehicle if you were in receipt of attendance allowance and if you had a blue disabled driver's badge. But, you know, we'd have elderly people who'd never been on a computer, so couldn't apply. One Irish lady, Carmen, who she was kind of past 80, and she still works in phlebotomy at St Helier Hospital a few days a week. And she drives her car to get there because she couldn't walk there or get on the bus there. She's disabled. And she was disabled, and she had a blue badge, and she could get a parking space at St Helier Hospital in the car park. But she didn't claim attendance allowance. And I said, I'm really sorry, Carmel, we've got to get you attendance allowance to get you this extension. And she said, Siobhan, I've been in this country for 60 years and I have never claimed a penny in benefit, and I don't want to start now.
I think this is what.
What do you say to Carmel?
Well, I know, but there are Carmels up and down the country like that who feel that way. And I think sometimes when policies are designed, they don't think of people like Carmel.
No. So, I mean, And you know, that Dee, who's sitting next to me, who you can't see, I mean, she spent a lot of her time helping people to make applications. But there will be people out there who could get an extension who don't know, who simply don't use their card. Their world becomes smaller, and they don't do the things that they've always done. And I think that will have a profound effect on their quality of life. And they're not the people that we came into politics in order to do that to.
Well, hopefully, Siobhan, in a few months' time, you will be able to put these concerns to a Labour Prime Minister.
Yeah, let's hope so.
When do you think the
Because
election's going to be?
I don't know. I'm not as optimistic as the press appear to be. You know, I'm a bit more skeptical about opinion polls. To get the sort of swing that we need, if you get a 1997 style swing, you only get a majority of two. And I don't think we'd last very long on a majority of two. I think it would be quite hard. So we are asking for an unprecedented result. And at the moment, it doesn't feel like 1997 out there.
So do you think they will win?
I think we will. But there are kind of, there will be all lots of things going on. I think it will be, I think a lot of people will stay home and won't vote. And that's very sad. And that could have a disproportional impact on our results. I think a lot of Conservatives just cannot bring themselves to go and vote for them again.
Yeah, I mean that's what's tricky, isn't it? You want to win, but you don't want to win on a, you don't want to win and it feel grudging or tainted by an unusually low turnout.
Actually, at the moment, I'd win on anybody's. You know,
Okay.
I win to win, and we will prove that we were right to, you know, that it was right to elect us, I hope, you know, that we'll show what we can do. And you know, as somebody who didn't originally vote for Keir, I do have a lot of faith in what he's going to do and how he's going to do it.
Siobhan, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, there you go, Siobhan McDonough, and I've put some links in the blurb where you can follow the fantastic work she's doing to raise awareness about brain cancer. Obviously, her sister Margaret was such a big deal in the Labour Party. They both are. I mean, we're always fascinated by political siblings. Obviously, the Milibands are the ones that spring to mind, or political spouses. But it's so cool to be two sisters. One becomes an MP and a minister. The other becomes the General Secretary of the Labour Party. There is something, obviously, you think maybe in the genes about having that drive and having that going into that world, particularly as working class Irish immigrant stock, to just get involved and go for it. I find that so exciting. So Siobhan is a total inspiration. You can follow her work. I've put a link where you can follow her on social media. Relentlessly positive, often in the face, as she's experienced in relatively recent history, of the Labour Party becoming a place that really certainly headed in a direction she completely disagreed with, but having that, having the guts and the determination to stay throughout that very difficult period. I'll be back next week with another fantastic guest, and I'll see you then. Cheers.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.